Coming up on this episode of Nintendo Cartridge Society, we wrap up our ABCs of Nintendo DS real quick so we can take the Nintendogs for a walk. It's dangerous to go alone, so the Nintendo Cartridge Society goes with you. Welcome to Nintendo Cartridge Society. My name is Patrick Ellers, and I am joined, as I am always joined, by my co-host, Mark Mitchell. Mark, how's it going?
It's going great. I had a cold about like 2 weeks ago, and it turned into just congestion for the longest time.
Yes.
And now it's moved from nasal congestion to just like sitting in my throat.
Uh-huh.
And I'm telling you this because if like while we're recording, if you're talking or I'm like, I clear my throat suddenly, it's not because I have any like grand pronouncements
about the heir
to my estate.
Right. It's not a Dolores Umbridge interruption to correct me on my behavior.
That's right.
And make me carve a message in my hand that I will not tell wicked lies or whatever.
Exactly.
Is that what happened in that book?
That sounds right.
Okay. Okay, so you've got some throat congestion.
Yeah, some throat congestion.
How do you treat this sort of thing in your life? Should I have offered you tea earlier?
No, you know what? I've just given up on trying to do anything about it. No, except warn people that hey, this is a part of me now.
But that can't be true. It has to get better.
Does it? What about those people that get hiccups for like a million for 30 years? I was going to say a million years.
But no one lives
that long.
That's
just too much. That's hyperbole. But 30
yeah,
years.
30 years. Okay,
that's possible.
That's possible.
Yeah.
But it's not. I mean, first of all, if you had hiccups for 30 years,
uh-huh,
we'd have to stop doing this show.
We would.
I will not edit 30 years of hiccups out of the show.
Patrick drawing a line.
Yeah, it's where
it's fair. That's fair.
Look, if you want to take over the editing of the podcast.
No. If I.
Because we currently do almost nothing.
This is a promise.
Yeah.
If I get hiccups for 30 years, I'll just withdraw from the show.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean?
Like, yeah, I understand. Yeah, you'll bow out. It'll be a resignation.
Exactly.
And not, I won't have to fire
you.
But
I will. And in that case, it might be me clearing my throat to make that announcement and not just because I also. See, that would be the worst.
See,
if
now 30 years. Now I'm on edge because I don't know if the throat clearing
is. No, but you will know because I don't have hiccups.
I see.
Today.
Right in this moment.
Yeah.
It could still happen.
Chekhov's hiccups.
That's right. They've been mentioned. Put it on the board. It's something we got to track for the remainder of the year. Mark gets it. He gets hiccups, and maybe the beginning of 30-year hiccups, at which point he will resign from the show. If you don't want Mark to resign from this show, you can go to patreon.com/Nintendo Cartridge Society, where you can support us at the 8-bit, 16-bit, or the 4-bit level. If you are at the 8-bit or 16-bit level, you get access to our once-a-month episodes of miniseries that we put out there. We are about to record our episode of NCS Arcade about The Legend of Zelda, The Minish Cap.
Yeah, super excited for this. And if you have any thoughts that you want to be included in that episode, feel free to shoot us an email.
Yep, email us at NintendoCartridgeSociety@gmail.com. It's great to talk about the game and any games that we're playing or talking about on the show in our Discord. But if you want us to include any of those impressions in the episode, please email us because it is easier for us to compile them and kind of easier for you to express, I think, full and complete thoughts. But conversation is great, so if you would like to get in on some of that in our Discord, please email us at NintendoCartridgeSociety@gmail.com. And I will send you an invitation to the Discord. Lot of activity in the Discord this week as I was trying very hard to secure a pre-order for the Noah and Mio amiibo.
Any update? What do you have a plan?
And not only do I have a plan, I have a pre-order.
Oh, whoa!
Yeah, so I pulled
Hail
it off.
The conquering hero.
We're just doing Aladdin, right?
Oh yeah, I guess we are.
Yeah. What is that otherwise? Is that
I couldn't think if it was like a Looney Tunes, like a Bugs Bunny.
I mean, it's ba da 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 da, right?
Yeah.
Which is also a Bugs Bunny thing. The duck might be somebody's... A duck might be somebody's...
Oh, yeah, you're right.
Uh-huh. That's Daffy Duck.
But is that the actual song, or is that just, like, lyrics that are put to...
I would assume
an existing tune.
Yes, right. I would assume it is the latter. Okay. Lyrics put to an existing tune.
All of this is to say you secured a pre-order.
I secured a pre-order for these amiibo for characters that I do not know from a game I have not played.
Xenoblade Chronicles 3.
That's right. But it means that I am perfectly on track. Like, my goal of buy everything Nintendo puts out this year. Come Friday, I'm 2 for 2.
Yeah. You know, when you first set that goal.
Yeah.
I
don't like the way you said goal.
When you first said that goal, I was like, okay, I mean, this is achievable.
Uh-huh.
But then
it got hard.
Immediately it got hard.
Right away.
So, what a great example of overcoming adversity.
Thank you. Great point. Speaking of overcoming adversity, I do want to plug right here and now that I have a series of Ninja Turtles source books, sort of like encyclopedias for the IDW comic books coming out, being published by IDW, that I am writing. So if that is something that interests you, if you like Ninja Turtles, if you've been interested in the comics but don't know where to start, these source books are going to be a great resource. So go to your local comic book store, pre-order it. Issue one comes out February 21st, which we are, it's just a couple weeks away at this
point. Quickly approaching. And I haven't seen anything from it, but just you talking to me about it, I think these are going to be very cool.
That was real. Looks like you guys were having fun up there. Energy.
No, not at all.
No, I'm very excited. I'm very excited about it. I have sold it to you well, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. Well, Mark, what we have to do today is we have to finish a task that we started last week. Let's conclude our ABCs of Nintendo DS with N through Z. Now, we were talking before we started recording that in our A through M, we had no repeats between us.
Yeah, no overlap.
Usually there's something where you say it and then I am like, that's what my letter here was going to be. But we had none of that last time. Will we this time as we head into the end of the alphabet?
I don't know.
End of the alphabet is more tricky than the beginning of the alphabet.
Yes.
Just fewer words start with the letter X. So, like, what are you going to do? speaking of what are you going to do, would you like to go first here or should I?
Go ahead.
For my N, I am selecting a character who appears in a Nintendo DS game, a villain, Necrodius, who is the final boss of Kirby Mass Attack. Necrodius, who I don't really want to talk about, I want to talk about Kirby Mass Attack. Necrodius is a classic Kirby villain in that he resides in the Necro Nebula, is some sort of eldritch cosmic spirit horror thing, and commands the Skull Gang in a cute little Kirby game.
Uh-huh.
but mostly I just want to talk about Kirby Mass Attack, because it is like, the Kirby games get weird sometimes, especially when a touchscreen is involved, and they let you do these things where you are sort of indirectly controlling Kirby. This is the game where you have, like, hundreds of little Kirbys, and you're, like, putting them into balls and, like, throwing them around and, like, flicking them places with the stylus and sort of, like, tapping on the bad guys that you want to, have Kirby attack, and you have to, like, do different kind of, like, gestures on the screen to make them make them attack in certain ways. And it's one of the few examples of the DS successfully pulling off the using the stylus as input in an action game where the action feels satisfying. Like, I can really only think of this. I assume that Ninja Gaiden game was kind of like that, but I guess I don't know. Or at least, like, had some satisfying touch-based action. And Severed from Drinkbox had some very good touch-based action sequences. But it's a rare quality to achieve.
Yeah, and that made me think of the other, like, Mass Attack made me think of, like, the other Kirby game that I remember it from the Nintendo DS era, which was Canvas Curse.
Ah, yes.
Which is the one, like, there was a sequel on the Wii U called Rainbow Curse,
I believe, yeah.
But Canvas Curse, you
we
know...
We played a little Rainbow Curse.
We did, right, Curse for Kirby together, Month. Yeah. But Canvas Curse, you know, the input of it, similar to Rainbow Curse, is you're drawing the path for Kirby to take.
Right, right.
Including, like, loops and things like that.
But it's just one Kirby, and what's better than one Kirby but, like,
no,
a billion
true.
Kirbys?
Yeah,
and
hands down.
It's so funny, like, the Kirbys will, like, die off as they, like, get hit by enemies and stuff. But, like, you have to make it to the end with, like, enough Kirbys that this ball of Kirbys sits on, like, a scale, and, like, it has to weigh enough for the Kirbys to get through. It's a cool little game, and, like, I'm sort of bummed that they don't, like, revisit this type of Kirby game more frequently. Because how long ago was Rainbow Curse at this point? Like, almost a decade, right?
Probably, yeah, because the Switch has been out for...
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Yes.
7-8 years.
And, like, that thing has a touchscreen. Also, they made mobile games, so, like, I don't know. I don't understand what Nintendo's doing, but, yeah, Necrodius is
yeah,
my...
very good. I like that a lot.
Is my N.
My N...
Leader of the Skull Gang!
What was the galaxy that he's from?
He's from the Necronebula.
Necronebula.
Yeah.
That's good. My N is New Super Mario Brothers.
Yeah, great pull.
I feel like we've got to talk about the new Super Mario Brothers... series/game, which mm-hmm. I remember when it was announced was seismic.
Yeah, because it was the first new 2D Mario game in since World, right?
World, I guess. What came out? I think, like, I guess 6 Golden Coins probably.
Sure. Okay.
Came after that, I think, but still, that's over a decade.
Yeah,
with no traditional Mario side-scrolling game on any platform.
Yeah,
that's pretty.
It's a
crazy.
Long time. It's a long time. Yeah,
yeah, and it was a brand new Mario game, a brand new Mario side scroller. There hadn't been one since the Super Nintendo /
Game Boy. Yeah,
it brought a whole new art style.
Mm-hmm.
Love it or hate it, it defined the Mario universe.
That's true.
For like a decade, almost 2 decades. And I still remember that first, like, the trailer they showed where Mario gets the mushroom that makes
the mega
him,
mushroom.
The mega mushroom, and he grows gigantic and he's just, like, knocking everything out of the way.
Which is so funny. It's so funny, right? And that, like, he doesn't just, like, knock stuff out of the way. He, like, flattens stuff. Uh-huh. There are, like, mountains that he's just, like, boom, 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 and they're gone. And, like, a little meter fills up. Maybe you get, like, an extra life.
I can't remember.
Like, you went from crushing stuff.
But I feel like, as a gameplay mechanic, it turned out to not be that
fun. Pointless, yeah.
But it was very, like, flashy in the trailer. I don't know. Do you know, I think that the music, or at least the main theme for the new Super Mario Brothers series, I kind of, like, dismissed for the longest time.
Uh-huh.
And then there was this was probably like 5 or 6 years ago, there was an episode of the Super Mario Brothers video game music podcast, and they do a Nintendo month every year in November. And in one of those episodes, they played the new Super Mario Brothers theme, probably from one of the, like, newer games, probably from maybe the Wii U version,
just like the ground theme, the, like,
yeah, exactly,
da, 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 da,
uh-huh,
da, da, da.
With, like, all the different, like, the detail in it, like the
yeah.
different, like, sound samples and the way that they all play together, it really made me appreciate it much more when I feel like I had just kind of, like, dismissed the aesthetics of new Super Mario Brothers for a really long time.
Well, I mean, I do think that the aesthetics overall, both in the soundscape and in, like, the visually speaking, are meant to be as unobtrusive, as unnoticeable as possible, right? Like, the new Super Mario Brothers aesthetic goes down smooth, if unremarkably.
Yeah.
Right? I would say... no worries for not having not noticed that music earlier.
But
but it's good, yeah.
Yeah, the main theme is really good. So yeah, new Super Mario Brothers.
Great. New Super Mario Brothers, one of two games on the DS, two Mario games on the DS that had this whole suite of mini games. They're also available in the Mario 64 DS. And I remember playing the heck out of those mini games. Like, love them. There's the one where you have to, like, find it's Mario, Yoshi, Luigi, and Wario. Those are like the four faces. And it'll tell you like which one you have to find, and then there's just like a screen and you just like tap that face.
Oh, whoa.
And it just
totally
gets like
remember that.
Harder and harder and harder until they're like there's like hundreds of them like moving around on screen, and like they're like too fast or whatever. Like there's a blinking light. Yeah, just like a ton of like little, and that's those things. Like, where are those? Like, put those out again.
Yeah, that would be fun.
Cool, weird stuff.
Yep. On to my O then.
Yes.
So my O is for the Opera web browser. Which, when the Nintendo DSi released, it natively, just part of its like software, had a web browser. But, you know, like the DS was a lifestyle device.
Yeah.
And so they sold a web browser that you bought, you know, like a game card for.
Amazing.
Came in a little case.
Uh-huh.
And it was Opera. It was a version of the Opera web browser, so you could connect with that sweet Nintendo Wi-Fi connection and cruise the World Wide Web.
Yeah. That's incredible. Do you think if they were to why do you think they went with Opera? Like,
well, I don't think it was released by Nintendo.
Sure.
Yeah. And so
the Opera was the only company that was like, we should invest in this.
Put it out, I guess.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's just interesting, like, who do you think would, if they had to go through the trouble of like releasing a physical product for it, who do you think would go through that now? Like, what web browser would we be using? Safari on our Nintendo Switches?
Do you think it would be Microsoft Edge? Because
oh,
of that,
maybe.
Microsoft Nintendo connection.
Yeah.
No, okay, so I was incorrect. I just looked it up.
Yeah.
So it was called the Nintendo DS browser is what you would buy. Like, uh-huh. the physical thing that you purchased was called the Nintendo DS browser. And it was developed by Opera Software and Nintendo.
Whoa!
Yeah, so it was, I think it was published by Nintendo. And it was the Opera web browser running on your Nintendo DS.
So now that's interesting because, you know, a couple years later when the Wii comes out, it has a web browser on it natively.
Right, and so did the Nintendo DSi, which was released after the Wii.
And are those based on the browser like co-developed by Opera and Nintendo?
Let's see. The Nintendo DSi is incompatible with the browser and any memory expansion, but is the free and the Nintendo DSi browser looking now. The Nintendo DSi web browser was a version of the Opera browser.
Oh yeah. And the Nintendo Wii web browser, it's also a version of the Opera browser.
Weird.
Yeah. So Nintendo was just like, here's who we trust for browsing the web on our hardware right now. Opera. Okay. That's a very good O, Mark. My O is, I gotta say, also very good. On Tour, Guitar Hero On Tour.
There we go.
Which is an absurd game and set of peripherals. Guitar Hero, of course, all the rage at this point, right? This is like the heyday of Guitar Hero, of Rock Band. And so they were like, let's make sure that people can play these on the machines that are selling more than any of the rest of them, right? That means the DS. Now, to play Guitar Hero On Tour, you have one peripheral that goes into the GBA pack slot that has three buttons on it. They could only fit three buttons, right? And then the other peripheral that you have is a stylus that is also a guitar pick. So it's like a regular looking guitar pick with like that little plastic nub at the end of it. And then you can play Guitar Hero by strumming the bottom screen with the stylus and then using the three buttons to, you know, make chords and stuff.
So were you holding it? Do you know, were you holding it like book style? Was it like,
I mean, it's sort of hard to see. You're holding it sideways for sure. But uh-huh. Like you gotta,
I guess that's true.
Yeah.
You're like claw gripping it.
Yeah. It's really uncomfortable to hold. And like, there's no good place for you to both see it and hold your hand like comfortably. So like you could really only play it for like 10 or 12 minutes at a time before you're like, I gotta put this down. Cause also like your other hand has to be so close to it, right? Like you're just, it's, the like common crack against Guitar Hero is that it's like nothing like playing real guitar, and playing Guitar Hero on tour is like nothing like playing Guitar Hero, you know. So it was just, it's a very funny, bizarre experience. I believe because it had all that like extra hardware in it, it was like an $80 game or something like that. And yeah, it's just like just a weird little mess that will hurt your hands. And also, it's not like the speakers in the DS were very good. Like you had to use headphones, and you know, even then was just like not a super positive experience.
While you were describing that, I was trying to think of, oh, is there a way that you could do like a one person rock band using, because you have the microphone?
Yep, you have the
singing.
Microphone. Yeah. Oh God, I wish it had incorporated singing. That would have been so good.
I guess you could use the bottom. Well, no, because I was gonna say like you could use the bottom touchscreen for the drums, but then you lose.
You gotta
the strumming.
Be strumming on it. Yeah. Too. The I mean, the thing that I do think is really cool about it is that the, you know, you're actually using a pick to strum the thing, which none of the other the rest of the Guitar Hero guitars and Rock Band guitars all had like a little strum bar, but like. You actually used a pick for the 3DS for the DS version. So always thought that was cool.
Yeah, that's fun.
All right. So my P is Picross 3D, baby. Now you may say, hold on a minute, we're not talking about 3DS. And I'll say, I know Picross 3D started on the regular old Nintendo DS.
Ahead of its time,
seemingly knew what the future would hold. I've never actually played the versions of Picross 3D on the DS, but I absolutely love this. I mean, I'm a big Picross booster, generally speaking, and I love especially Picross 3D 2 on the 3DS is just a phenomenal version of that game. Impossible to buy now, of course, because the 3DS eShop has closed down. But what a game. This kind of like doing this research and discovering that there is one on DS made me want to seek out that cartridge. Like I would like to have Picross 3D in my collection so I can play the DS version on my 3DS.
That really is one of the unspoken benefits of, I know there's the DS eShop, but of like the fact that the Nintendo DS did not have an eShop is all of
yes.
these games that later would just be like eShop releases. And if like, I don't know if the Picross games got like physical releases on 3DS,
I think the 3D ones might have.
Okay.
But yeah.
But yeah, but like anything that was released for the Nintendo DS, basically outside of DSiWare,
exists somewhere.
Yeah. Like yeah. Those carts exist. Those game cards exist.
Yeah. Well, I mean, remember last week I was talking about the Game & Watch collections that like have these. I mean, there's the one that has like the bizarre mashup of Parachute and Octopus. If that were released 10 years later, it would have obviously only been a digital download.
Yeah.
But the fact that it had to be released physically means that those things still exist in the world.
I know. I have to confess that this past week I've been just like looking. I've been totally in like a Nintendo DS.
Yes.
Like memory mood.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been looking at like, oh, should I buy some Nintendo DS cards?
It's a mistake. You don't want to,
right? I know.
But I think you should do it. Because I think you'll have a great time.
My P
mm-hmm.
is for pillar, as in third pillar.
Fantastic.
So
yes.
We
touched on this a little bit last week.
We did, yeah. When the Nintendo DS was first announced by Nintendo, they were in hedging their bets mode
mm-hmm.
because, you know, so it was presented as this is not replacing the Game Boy.
Right.
This is not replacing a home hardware. This is a third pillar, a whole new vertical that
right.
we're exploring.
Right. Seemingly saying, don't worry, Pokemon will still come out for Game Boy Advance.
Exactly.
Right?
And if this fails, The Game Boy still exists.
We don't ever have to talk about it again.
Right, exactly. Right. We can Virtual Boy this. We can
no
throw this
problem.
In the same
yes.
memory hole right. as Virtual Boy exists. And
in the same hole that the Wii U would eventually go
right, right. And so that, of course, turned out to not be the case. The Nintendo DS was incredibly successful and killed the Game Boy line.
Yeah.
But looking back on it, with the benefit of knowing how well the Nintendo DS did, it's interesting to see, like, Nintendo framing it in a way that they're like, we kind of know that everybody thinks this is crazy.
Yes, that they're like, okay, so we're releasing a new product, and the fact that there is a new product requires explanation, right?
Yeah, uh-huh.
it's so interesting to think that, like, they were, because, you know, for most of Nintendo's time being active in the North America, they've been two pillar, right? There they had been two pillar, with the Game Boy coming out in 89. The NES had only been in the States for, I guess, a couple years at that point. But even still, like, the NES and Game Boy, and then NES or Super NES and Game Boy, like, just made a lot of sense. People got it, right? And it's remarkable. They're like, here's another one. I don't know.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, that's interesting, because you're totally right. Because even later, you know, you had the GameCube and mm-hmm. the Game Boy Advance. Like, that it was yes. just for the longest time there was Nintendo's home hardware, and then there was their its portable hardware,
right? And they were both on, like, sort of separate tracks, and, like, sometimes the releases would, like, feed into each other. You know, if in Quest 64 also had a Game Boy Color game, right? Is Game Boy Color, or is it GBA? I think it's Color.
I'm not sure. If it was Quest 64, it was probably Color.
Probably, yeah. And, like, Conker's Bad Fur Day also had, like, a Conker adventure-y game on the Game Boy Advance. So, like, these the two platforms, like, were talking to each other, and then they were like, I don't know, now a third one.
And you also have to remember that at the time Nintendo was on its heels.
A little bit.
The Game Boy Advance was successful, but it had been out for 3 or 4 years.
And it was no Game Boy, right?
Like, right, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, the Game Boy was a phenomenon.
And the GameCube was...
not.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. A phenomenon, I think. And the Game Boy had multiple, like, phenomenon cycles, right? Like, it had its original release with Tetris being huge, and then, you know, Pokemon comes along, like, 8 years later or mm-hmm. something, and the whole thing just blows up again. But yeah, so, like, having the DS come along was, like, something that there was an injection of excitement that Nintendo needed. It's always so interesting when we do these things looking back on, like, Nintendo history and trying to, like, contextualize things, where it's like, oh, there's no, like, stable time in Nintendo's history, right? Like, they are boom and bust, and they're in the middle, like, right now in 2024. Are they riding a boom still? Are we on the other side of the boom? Are we gonna head into a bust? Like, there's just no way to know,
right? I guess the one way it is encouraging with the benefit of history is you're like, well, they'll probably pull through the next bust.
Yes I agree with that, because they are, like, a fairly conservative company in that regard. So, like, they're building their war chest right now, and they can weather some bad years if they have to.
And they seem to find ways to,
yeah,
like, innovate their way out of hard times.
Yeah. Well, and, like, right now, you know, we've talked about it before, but they only have the one gaming pillar right now. They have, I guess, the second pillar in the form of just, like, entertainment, right?
Right.
The Mario movie. The theme parks, and then everything else that's going to come out in the future.
Yeah, so they're, like, collaborations with Lego and, yep, like, all that stuff that they've really leaned into in the past, like, decade.
Yep. So your P, now your Q.
Yeah, my Q. Okay, so my Q is IQ DS. So IQ is a collaboration with a person, Nintendo's collaboration with a person named Wei Yen to localize products for mainland China.
Okay.
And the partnerships started in 2002 and lasted until 2018. And so they released something called the IQ Player, which was kind of like the Nintendo 64 equivalent, but they also released the IQ GBA, the IQ SP, the IQ Micro, which were all, like, the Game Boy Advance, yep, variations. And then they had the IQ DS, the IQ DS Lite, and the IQ DSi. And these, the GBA versions and the DS versions, and they released one 3DS version, The form factor is the same, but then when you like the boot up screen and everything says like the logo is similar, but it says like the two squares, but it says IQDS.
Hmm.
And more recently, Nintendo, you know, partnered with Tencent, I think it was.
Yep.
For the Switch, and so like Nintendo hardware is officially available in mainland China, but in around 2003, during that time, the Chinese government had banned imports of video game consoles.
No video games.
Yeah, and so there, so this collaboration was their way to kind of like introduce Nintendo hardware under a different name, but only 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Only 6 games were ever released.
What?
Yeah, for the...
Do you have the list of what those 6 games are?
I do, so it's Polarium, WarioWare Touched, Yoshi Touch and Go, Super Mario 64 DS, New Super Mario Brothers,
okay,
and Nintendogs. And then Big Brain Academy was at one time planned, but ended up unreleased.
Mm.
And the releases run a very long time. So it's like, there were 2 releases in 2005, and then it's like... one in 2006, one in 2007, none in 2008, and 2 in 2009.
Hmm.
So definitely, you know, like a very limited library,
really
officially available. I'm sure piracy was kind of like bonkers on it. But just an interesting, the whole like IQ collaboration is just an interesting little fork of Nintendo history. And I had to look up to see if they, because I knew that they had released like Nintendo 64 games, but I didn't realize that they had done all of the
all these
the
other
handheld too.
Yeah, that's nuts. Great cue, Mark. My cue is going to be for Q Games, a developer of many things. They mostly did like the Pixel Junk games prior to the release of their big Nintendo DS game, which is of course Star Fox Command. And I just wanted to shout out Star Fox Command generally here, which is just a bizarre game. Have you ever had the pleasure?
No, I've never played it.
So it is half like bite-sized Star Fox game, right, where you are getting into these combat encounters that are like small versions of Star Fox levels, sometimes where they're like that sort of open zone, you're like flying around in 360. And so it's half that and half sort of like strategy game where you're drawing the flight paths of your various R-wings on the bottom screen, and then you like encounter the enemy units down there, and then it becomes that's the Star Fox levels on the top screen.
Huh.
So like kind of cool idea, mostly doesn't work slash like isn't like actually fun in practice, but it does do a great job of just like expanding the world of Star Fox in a way that I sort of can't believe other Star Fox games haven't like replicated. There are 14, Mark, 14 playable characters in Star Fox Command. You got that's right. I wanted to see if you could name 14 Star Fox characters.
No, there's no way. The brow sweat was already forming.
All right, we got Fox McCloud, Falco Lombardi, Crystal, Slippy Toad, Peppy Hare, Wolf O'Donnell, Panther Caruso, Leon Powalski, Slippy's fiance Amanda, Peppy's daughter Lucy, Bill Gray, Cat Monroe, Andross's grandson Dash Bowman, and James McCloud. You could play as James McCloud.
That's amazing. Can we go back to Lucy for a second? Was that her name?
Yeah, Peppy's daughter.
Oh no. What is Slippy's
Amanda?
Slippy and Amanda.
I love that. Like in the Star Fox universe, it's like, all right, the men, your names are Slippy and Grippy. The women, you're Amanda.
No, it's true. It's like the old sitcom trope, you know, of like the doofy husband,
right?
And then
you
know, like Amanda's got it together. In that relationship, Amanda's the one who like knows everything.
Yes. Yep. So Q Games, shouting out Q Games for their absurd work on Star Fox Command.
You know what I remember about the conversation around Star Fox Command is that I guess maybe that's Q Games, like Dylan Cuthbert, the Wonderkin who developed was on the development team of like the FX chip on the Super Nintendo that made
Star Fox,
Star Fox possible, that he was like back to work on Star Fox Command.
Yeah. Well, and it's like it is interesting because there are like pieces of Star Fox Command that you can see in Star Fox 2. Like since it's been re-released or like actually released with the Super NES Classic Edition and with the Super NES library on Nintendo Switch Online, that like it's crazy. Like some of those little bite-sized levely things are in that game that's sort of like free roaming. It was a little bit like a return to form in that they were like going back to pieces that they had used before and bringing Cuthbert back in the form of Q Games is just a bizarre little artifact.
Did you play Star Fox Command at all?
Mm-hmm.
Was the microphone used at all?
Ooh, not to my recollection.
Mm, okay.
I mean,
just with the name like Command. I know there's the drawing part, but I just wasn't sure if there's like barrel roll.
Well, no, I mean, like I did go bah, 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 bah. And then they did a barrel roll. Mark from my R has got to be Racing, Diddy Kong Racing, DS, which is a heartbreaking game for me. I loved the original Diddy Kong Racing on the Nintendo 64. It's got like an overworld. It's got an adventure mode, fun tracks, cool characters, three different vehicles that you drive, and like the tracks change basically based on which vehicle you're going through it with. And when it was re-released on DS, I was ecstatic because I was like, great, here's another opportunity for me to play this game and play it on the go. A Nintendo 64 game on the go, that's the promise of the DS right there. But a couple things are different right off the bat. Because Rare is no longer making games for Nintendo, the Rare specific characters that were in the lineup, gone. Banjo, gone. Conker, gone. And they're replaced by Dixie Kong, I believe, and who replaces Banjo? Maybe Tiny Kong? It doesn't matter. Someone else. But the real crime here is that the game, you know how in Mario Kart, there's like the little countdown before you go that like, dee, 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 bah, and you push the button at the right time to get a little boost off the start line. So there was a mechanic like that in Diddy Kong Racing, which is just normal. You push a button at the right time, you get a little boost. In Diddy Kong Racing DS, there's some way that you had to interact with the novel features of the DS in order to get that boost. So like with the hovercraft, for example, there's like a little propeller that appears on the bottom screen and you have to take the stylus and spin it around real fast, spin the propeller on the touch screen to get the boost. And then you got to like throw the stylus so you can like put your hands on the buttons and actually play the game. There's one of them where you have to blow into the microphone to get the boost. And I forget what the third one is, but they're all bad. And like all put you in like a weird physical position that you then have to like get out of in order to actually play the game.
That is weird.
And there was no way to like turn them off or like select the regular, boost. It was bad. A bad choice.
Yeah. I did not play a lot of Diddy Kong Racing on the Nintendo 64. And so the DS version just kind of like passed me by. But I remember I feel like this is like Star Fox Command all over again. But my memory of the conversation is exactly what you're saying.
Yeah.
That these small, like, these changes ended up having, like, a big impact on the enjoyability of the game.
Yeah, and, like, I wouldn't have minded, if the game was still playable, I wouldn't have minded the character change.
Uh-huh.
Changes. That's all fine. I could have dealt. And also, like, kind of nice to have Dixie and Tiny Kong in there, like, just to have, you know, some female characters in the game. But yeah, I mean, just what a garbage fire with those boosts. Really, really, really bad choices.
My R is for redesigns. And this is another one that we touched a little bit on in the first part. But I think, correct me if you can think of a different instance, but I think the Nintendo DS might be the Nintendo hardware with the most amount of like revisions and like hardware revisions.
I mean, I feel like 3DS might have it beat, just because it goes like 3DS, new 3DS, 3DS XL, new 3DS XL. Well, I guess that's it. That's just those four, right?
Right. And so that
DS, DS Lite.
So maybe it's tied because it's DS, DS Lite, DSi, and then later like the DSi XL.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, and that's a lot. And like, with the exception of the I to XL, like they're all huge steps up.
Yeah, they're all just getting like thinner and thinner.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But yeah, the, like I mentioned before, the Nintendo DS is the system, the Nintendo system by far that I both bought the most of.
Do you think there's a non-Nintendo system that you bought more of?
No, definitely not. Right. It's definitely just the video game hardware that I purchased. Because I owned
like phones,
at
maybe.
Least eight, I yeah, at least one version of every version of Nintendo DS.
Yeah. Yes, very good. Lots of revisions.
My S.
Although if they do another Switch, then that'll also be tied at four, right? Because we've got original Switch, Lite, and OLED.
Yeah. Yeah. And that does feel very possible.
That, it does, yeah.
Like, because, you know, even like the Wii, which didn't get very many revisions at the end of its life, it, you know, it got a new version,
right?
And so I could totally see, like, in the sunset years, the Nintendo Switch, here's like a final redesign.
I mean, maybe it depends on how different the next thing is, right? Like, I think part of the reason that they were like did the Wii revision is that what they were going into next was going to be different, right? Like the Wii U is an HD console with this like tablet, and they're like, well, you know, like put out a new thing now that, you know, people can continue to play their Wii stuff on, and like sell that again. But yeah, if it's just like, if the new Switch is just like more Switch, I don't know why you would bother revising the old Switch.
I guess that's true, unless you can make it cheaper,
if you can,
or
make
like
it cheaper,
better somehow. Yeah, interesting. On to my S.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so my S, we got to talk about it. It's the Nintendo DS. It's for second screen.
Oh, yep.
The Nintendo DS had two screens.
I thought for sure you were going to say stylus, which is one of my two choices.
Oh, that's funny. Stylus was my other choice.
Oh, great, great, great. Yeah. Okay, so let's do your S, and then we'll do my S, and then we'll talk about the stylus.
Okay, great.
Okay.
Yeah. So the second screen. A surprising, like, I know that the Nintendo Switch has a touchscreen, but having two screens,
yes,
one that is like a touchscreen and then one that is just a regular screen, opened up a ton of different game like uses for that second screen.
It's sort of wild, right? Like how much and how like how varied the approaches are to it. Like, what can that second screen be useful for? Which one are you considering the second screen?
Right.
Like, that's always exciting to discover, where you're like, oh, I play most of this game on the bottom screen. Oh, I play most of this game on the top screen. Or when there's, like, action going between screens is also very cool.
Yeah, and just, like, this relatively brief time between the DS and the 3DS where, you know, like, games like Etrian Odyssey,
yeah,
came to exist, where it's like, yeah, dungeon crawlers existed before, but one where you could map directly on, you know, like the bottom touchscreen.
Yeah.
And yeah, they've tried to work out a way to continue it onto the Switch with the recent like Etrian Odyssey re-releases, but it was so in, like, it just makes so much sense for something like that to happen on the Nintendo DS. The World Ends With You, like we talked about last week. Like you said, so varied, so many different things. A completely new control scheme for Zelda games. Like, there was so much that could be done with it, or just using it as like a great menu, right? Not having to constantly press start to open up the menu. It's there all the time. It totally, this was on the 3DS, but it really like opens up the way that you, it makes playing games like Ocarina of Time just so much smoother. And
you're not, oh man, the way, I mean, also just Ocarina of Time, you have like all these like different options for like buttons and stuff. And also, yeah, that you can just like use items by like pressing down on the touch screen. Or like New Super Mario Brothers would have this too, where your stored item was just down there and you could just tap it and then it like popped out into the world.
Yep.
That kind of thing is just very, I do feel like we lose a little something going forward in a world without a dual screen experience.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, you know, the Wii U was able to capture some of that as well.
Yeah.
But, you know, even when, it was just the second screen, having a touch screen at the bottom, just really opened up a lot of new avenues for game developers.
I also, I just like the idea of the second screen being like part of Nintendo's DNA, right? Like there is the whole series of Game & Watch games that are dual screen. Some of my favorite, like Donkey Kong, like Greenhouse, use the two screens and just to like a cool effect to just have like, you just have more screen real estate, which is for whatever reason, super appealing and fun. All right, let's talk about the stylus and then we'll do my ass.
Okay.
Okay. Because the stylus, I feel like, is in this sort of the same conversation.
Yeah.
As the second screen. Because it is, you know, now we have all moved on to a stylus-free existence.
Yeah,
right?
Like capacitive touch screens.
That's right. We touch with our fingers now and not with little plastic pens. But there's, I feel like you get so much more accuracy with a stylus. Like my finger, it's not particularly fat, but like, it's there's no accuracy there.
Uh-huh.
That's all.
Yeah, no, I agree. I also think back to games like if you're just you know, selecting an item on the bottom screen.
Yeah.
You know, I a lot of times wouldn't pull the stylus out for games that like that's all it requires. But talking about like The Legend of Zelda Phantom Hourglass or something,
right,
that would not be fun to play dragging your finger across the screen,
absolutely,
you know, for hours at a time. Like there were some benefits to being able to use
right.
that stylus,
just like Kirby Mass Attack. Like it's the same thing where it's like you're doing these like slashing and tapping motions, and if you're doing it with your finger, it just feels like you're like thudding or like you're hitting the system, but with a stylus it feels a little bit more intentional. Although
yeah.
with the stylus you do end up sort of like nicking up that bottom screen.
You do really bad.
It gets pockmarked pretty bad.
Uh-huh.
But what are you gonna do?
Yep, you hold it under an angle at under like a lamp or something.
Yeah, like,
you
oh,
definitely
no.
yep yeah. I mean the day of like DS like screen protectors.
Yep.
To yep. try to keep it a little bit nicer.
But then you just ruin the screen protector uh-huh. and like peel that off and the whole thing is ruined. Anyway, my S, my real S, not the stylus S, is, and I'm not going to talk about this for very long, but Starlo. Starlo is a character, a little pixie sprite-like character from Mario and Luigi Bowser's Inside Story. This little character who gets swallowed by Bowser along with Mario and Luigi. And is the thing that actually talks to Bowser from inside and then comes back and talks to Mario and Luigi. So in much the same way that you, the player, are going back and forth between controlling those different sets of characters, so too does Starlo go back and like communicate to both those characters.
I've never played any of those games. I feel like I should.
Maybe. I mean, Superstar Saga is on the Nintendo Switch Online. Both it and Bowser's Inside Story got remakes on the 3DS, and who knows if they will bring any of the rest of them out to I guess is Superstar Saga, there was another one that was on Game Boy Advance, right?
I'm not sure.
I don't know. I don't know the series well enough
yeah
really. I mean they're light RPGs, right? They're they fall in that like Mario vein and are fun for what they are. All right, on to my T. This is where I feel like we could start to get into overlap territory. My T is for Tingle's Balloon Fight.
Ah.
Tingle's Balloon Fight, another game that is a Club Nintendo reward, but only in Japan. And again, this is a thing that if it were released 5 years later, would have just been a digital release for sure, because the game is truly just Balloon Fight, except instead of the little dudes in Balloon Fight, you play as Tingle. The box art for this is incredible. Mark, do yourself a favor and look up Tingle's Balloon Fight, the box art, because it is the box art for Balloon Fight, but there's like a little cutout of Tingle that's just like taped on it. And the title of the game, you know, in Japanese, Tingle's Balloon Fight, is just like, it appears to be affixed with scotch tape on the front of the on the front of the box art. Truly hilarious stuff. And I also like love the idea that, you know, this was before like virtual consoles and everything like that. So anytime that they trot out a like classic Nintendo game, they, you know, it's like an event. These things are, you know, weren't available for a long time on modern hardware. But here's Balloon Fight. And Balloon Fight is, you know, a Nintendo sort of classic, I guess, but it's not part of the like hailed gaming canon or anything like that. So like, here's a game that you maybe missed when you were a kid and played a lot of NES games, and it's got your favorite Tingle in it, and just looks like a fun, silly Tingle time. And the graphics are all like updated, so you know, the backgrounds aren't just like a static black sky. Tingle's Balloon Fight is another one that I'm like, should I try to get a copy of this? Oh, were they region free? Were
The Nintendo DS was region free, I think.
Okay, all right. Well, then I should really try to get this thing.
The Nintendo DS was a boom time for Tingle games.
Yes,
in Japan.
Yeah,
there were 1, 2, 3, 4 Tingle things released.
Right. I mean, one of those is the alarm clock, right?
So there's
on the DSi.
Freshly picked. Yeah. That's right. Freshly picked Tingle's Rosie Ruby Land.
An incredible name, by the way.
And I think this one got a European release.
Okay.
But none of these came to America. Tingle's Balloon Fight DS.
Mm-hmm.
Too Much Tingle Pack, which was, it includes several applications, like a calculator, a little dancing Tingle image, a fortune teller, a timer, and a coin flipping minigame.
It's amazing the things you could sell.
And then Ripen Tingle's Balloon Trip of Love.
Yeah.
Yeah. Darn. Just that we missed out on all of these.
We did. We missed out on every single one. All right. But Mark, I trust then that your T is not Tingle's Balloon Fight.
That's true. It's not Tingle's Balloon Fight. Mine, I feel like we don't need to dwell on that long because we've touched on it in our discussions, most recently of S. But I touch. Like the fact that the Nintendo DS, the main interface, or like the main like innovation, was this touchscreen.
Yeah.
Again, one of those things that now we just kind of like take for granted because it's something that all of our smartphones do, but was like a wholly differentiating,
yeah,
like selling point for the Nintendo DS. And the fact that it had a touchscreen, again, just like opened up so many avenues for creative gameplay.
It's also not something that other, like the other big gaming companies really took a shot at. I mean, it's the PlayStation Vita had a touchscreen, had two touchscreens, one in front and one in back. That back touchscreen is a problem because it's also not really a screen. It's just like a touchpad. And also you're always like accidentally touching it, activating it. But like there's no part of like the Microsoft controller that has a touch screen. I guess the modern PlayStation controller has like this little like touch pad, but you know, never really utilized in like an active way in the same way,
yeah,
that DS, 3DS, and Wii U games did.
Yeah, absolutely. On to my U.
Mm-hmm.
My U is for Underdog. This is another one that
in the same vein as Pillar.
Yeah, I feel like in some ways we have talked about it, but
Under Nintendog?
Huh? Oh, yeah, under Nintendog. Yeah, that's right. I feel like the Nintendo DS, you just, like we talked about a little bit earlier, have to remember that it came at a time when Nintendo seemed like they were about to be like completely knocked out, right? They were kind of like discounted, and with the pending release of the PSP around the same time as the Nintendo DS, it seemed like the Nintendo 64 and PlayStation, original PlayStation battle was about to play out again, where it's like, well, of course the PSP is going to be the successful, the most successful of these two pieces of hardware.
And it was an incredibly successful piece of hardware. It's sort of remarkable that both of them were successful, right?
Right, yeah. But
the market just wanted handheld gaming, I guess.
I think the market just wanted handheld gaming, but I think also, like, Nintendo, they bet on a different strategy, right?
Yeah, you're right.
They bet on this blue ocean strategy. Mm. As I think Iwata, like, was, like, called it. And the idea was, like, you know, like, focusing on innovation. So instead of trying to compete on technical specs, right? Like, they would compete on doing something different,
right?
Doing something, like, unique.
Almost like experiential specs. Like,
right.
Here are the things you can experience on our machine that you can't elsewhere.
Exactly. And in doing that, like, inviting a different audience to gaming.
Yeah.
And making it, like, I think one of the big things with touch, and that we saw with we also saw with the Wii's motion controls, was accessibility, right?
Yeah.
Like, so many of the Nintendo DS's software, not necessarily like games, but you interacted with it with the touchscreen, or, you know, brain training, you would write things out using the stylus, you know,
right.
Just like things like that. It was relatively affordable.
Or you would speak to it. Bah, 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 bah.
Yeah, that's right. You know, so, like, they just took a totally different path and it ended up paying off big time.
A thought just occurred to me that, like, you know, that introducing this, like, second way, you know, through touch and then through motion controls with the Wii, like, that was their way to sort of break down the barrier of, like, it's okay if you didn't grow up with games, if, like, games missed you when you were younger because they didn't exist yet, or didn't exist, like, in your homes when, you know, for, like, my parents, for example.
Or just became too complicated
because, you know, you have to play a first-person shooter with two different thumbsticks at the same time just to move around. And if that is less of a thing now because people who are older now, people like you and I, who are in our, you know, like, we're older gentlemen. I'm 41. That I grew up with a controller in my hands. So, like, a barrier that you would have to break through 17 years ago, is not a barrier that you would have to break through for someone in my age group right now.
Yeah, totally.
That is a good, what was that? You.
Yep. Yeah.
For under Nintendo.
Under Nintendo.
Very good. My U is for Akira Ueda. So the U is for his last name, Ueda. He was a designer for Square, and then went on to direct four games. Okay. Two Game Boy games, or two GBA games, one PlayStation 2 game, and then a quirky little RPG published by a Grasshopper manufacturer called Contact. And Contact is a bizarre game that, I don't know if it pitched itself or if just, like, the gaming press was pitching it on its behalf as a sort of, like, successor to the mantle of Earthbound, where it was a sort of warped version of, like, suburban America-ish as you explore things that happen when aliens are around. And it was a bizarre game that had a conceit where you took the role of the player who was controlling the character, and so, like, there's like a doctor on the top screen who would talk to you, the player, and be like, move this dude around, and so you would do that, and it was all very fourth wall breaking and very much in the vein of the Grasshopper manufacturer, like, you know, the Suda 51 style, like, mind twisty games, but in the package of, like, kind of a cute RPG, which I bought and played a lot of and found mostly confounding. Contact is not a friendly game, and it is not a user-friendly game. It's confusing. You'll get stuck. You'll get lost. But it's like a bizarre little experience.
Yeah, I definitely remember it being talked up in gaming magazines at the time.
Well, and, like, the it's just so strange, right? That, like, whether people were talking it up or just talking about it, it's sort of hard to tell the difference. I just wanted to Ueda's other games that he directed. He directed two GBA games that were, like, sequels to the Shining Force games from Sega. So, actually developed by Grasshopper and published by Atlas and Sega. They're called Shining Soul and Shining Soul 2. And then the game that he directed for PlayStation 2 is called Michigan, : Report from Hell. Which looked like it was sort of a like, what if Chicago was Silent Hill?
Or like, what if Detroit was Silent
Hill?
No,
because the Michigan here is referring to Lake Michigan.
Oh.
And the game takes place in or outside Chicago.
Okay.
But Michigan, Report from Hell.
I mean, that is a good title.
It's a great title. Look up the box art if you get a chance. It's really, really, really strange. A game I would like to check out. I had never heard of before. Also, it should take place in Michigan because there is a Hell, Michigan.
Huh.
Like, that's the name of a city in that state.
Yeah.
Anyway, now my V.
Yep.
My V is for Vibe Island. Are you familiar with Vibe Island,
Mark? I'm not.
Vibe Island is the setting of Super Princess Peach.
Oh.
The game where you control Princess Peach. The game got a lot of flack when it came out and sort of in the years since. And like, you heard some of it like bubbling up again with the announcement of Princess Peach Showtime, that the this first game where she's the hero is kind of crummy in that all of her powers are emotion based, and having the female protagonist who only has powers because she's manipulating emotion feels bad. But the game doesn't refer to them as emotions or feelings, but as vibes. And now, You just got to remember that we're in like 2009 or something like that when this game comes out. And people weren't just throwing around the word vibes.
No. Princess Peach, the original Gen Z.
I think she was. Vibes Island, or Vibe Island, is the it's off the coast of the Mushroom Kingdom. And it's where the whole game takes place. Bowser steals the vibe scepter. Princess Peach has a little vibe gauge that she fills up so she can use her vibe powers. So I just think, like, what a trendsetter.
Yeah.
We got to give it up to Peach. She was leading the way on Vibe before the rest of us were. And that all happens on Vibe Island.
That's awesome. My V is for Viva Pinata Pocket Paradise. Which is, so Viva Pinata.
I love these end of the alphabet
entries. Uh-huh. So Viva Pinata was a Xbox 360 game developed by Rare that originally, like, the germ of the idea started when Rare was still partnered with Nintendo.
Yes.
And then, but the, you know, you brought up Diddy Kong Racing DS, which was also developed by Rare.
Mm-hmm.
And then Viva Pinata Pocket Paradise was the, like, last game that Rare developed, like, new game that Rare developed for Nintendo, for Nintendo hardware. Because at this point, they were owned by Microsoft. But the thing that both of those games being brought up, you know, now we see Microsoft having a fairly friendly relationship with Nintendo.
Sure.
You know, like, they release, there's rumors that they are going to release Sea of Thieves or Hi-Fi Rush,
mm-hmm,
on Nintendo Switch in the future. They've already released, you know, like the Ori games. Did, mm-hmm, they? And yeah. And
yep,
so
both of them.
But it's just interesting that it goes back so long that even,
yeah,
you know, in the it's like Nintendo's been playing its own game for so long that Microsoft has, it's like they are competitors in the same space, kind of, but like, that's
right,
not really the relationship that they have.
Yeah, the relationship always strikes me as odd. Oh no, I just had a thing and now I don't remember what it was gonna be. Well,
if it comes back to you,
if it comes back to me, I'll interrupt either myself or you to interject it here. But yeah, Viva Pinata. What was the gameplay of these?
So Viva Pinata, at least the Xbox game, the Xbox 360 game, is like, it's like a kind of like a gardening game, and so you have this space that you are cultivating. And as you grow different plants, or like, as you expand, then these animal type things that look like piñatas will show up on your in your garden. First they show up like in black and white, and then if you do certain tasks, then they like they get filled in with color.
Yeah.
And then eventually you could get like a second one of that same type could show up in your garden. And then there's other like tasks for you to do. And if you do those, if you complete those tasks, then they do like a mating dance.
Oh.
And, you know, they make like other piñatas. Yeah. And so it's, and there's, you know, different species and different breeds and like all that kind of stuff. And so, I feel like at the time it was kind of compared to like Animal Crossing, you know,
okay.
like Microsoft's take on like Animal Crossing or something like that. But that's the gameplay of that series.
I remembered what I wanted to talk about.
Oh, perfect.
And that's the relationship between Microsoft and Nintendo does feel like there's no other like, you know, modern parallel for like that specific relationship. It is. Can you think of another example of a large development studio like Rare being owned by one of the three console manufacturers and then being sold to another console changing hands? It doesn't happen.
Well, was Rare ever, it was like part owned by Nintendo,
right? Yeah.
And that was like the whole thing is they wanted Nintendo to buy them wholesale when Nintendo was like, we pass. And so Microsoft picked them up. It is very bizarre.
It's a singular
thing. And I wonder
thing.
If that is kind of like, if that Rare connection was the seed for, you know, them,
it could be.
The two companies having a friendlier relationship.
Well, because that's so early in Microsoft's like console, it's the beginning of it, really, right? It is that's wild stuff to think about. Okay, so
I think it's my W.
Your W, yes.
And my W is for Wi-Fi, is in Nintendo Wi-Fi connection.
Yes.
And if you are not old people like Patrick and I,
mm-hmm.
then the idea that of a Nintendo console not having Wi-Fi, not having like internet, is probably like foreign and seems silly. But the Nintendo DS was, you know, by this time Xbox Live existed. You know,
right.
PlayStation had some form of online play for the PS2, but really Xbox Live was the standard bearer for online play. And Nintendo, you know, the GameCube had LAN connection for if you want to play Mario Kart Double Dash. You know, Game Boys had connector cables and that sort of thing.
Right. But nothing that actually brought them online.
No.
Right.
And so Nintendo Wi-Fi connection was a big deal. And like we talked about in last week's episode, playing Mario Kart DS online was incredible.
Felt like magic, yeah.
Yeah. Also, it was so early in like the relative age of the internet that a lot of people did not have Wi-Fi connections in their homes.
Right.
And so...
No, I remember that. Well, I mean, I was in college at the time, so like... I did not have a Wi-Fi router in my dorm room. We just had like the like cables, you know, the outlets, whatever, in each room. And it was like, well, I've got to go to a coffee shop to play this thing online.
Yeah, they sold a USB dongle
mm-hmm.
that basically what you would do is you would plug this USB accessory into a USB port on your computer,
yes,
which were like towers,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then that would generate a Wi-Fi signal that your Nintendo DS could connect to.
Right.
There were also, they had like, for a time anyways, in the US, they had a relationship with like Nintendo, a partnership with Nintendo. Not Nintendo, with McDonald's.
Ah, yes.
And to have like Wi-Fi hotspots for your Nintendo DS at like McDonald's restaurants.
Outrageous.
It was a different time.
It was, yeah. It's also just like such a weird throwback to consider like the time when we didn't all have like laptops. And even if you did have a laptop, you went like to the library and were like, okay, where can I hook this up into the internet? Because because you didn't,
totally.
Didn't have Wi-Fi. Yeah.
Yeah. The advent of friend codes right here in the Nintendo DS era with Nintendo Wi-Fi connection.
Nintendo Wi-Fi connection. Also just like that little sticker thing appearing. It wasn't actually a sticker, but just like
the blue logo. Yeah,
you can picture it so clearly. Nintendo Wi-Fi connection. Very good probably better than my W, which is White, which would later be renamed Polar White. We talked about this, I think, in the first episode mostly, but it's the DS Lite launched with this color. Eventually, the coral pink and the onyx colors would come a couple months later. But this Polar White was really the like shot across the bow of like Apple to be like, we're doing the cool looking thing that you do. The Nintendo DS is cool now.
Right. When the original Nintendo DS is
not cool,
is not cool.
Right.
And did not sell particularly well. It was the Nintendo DS Lite revision, like 18 months later in early 2006, that really kicked off Nintendo DS mania.
Right. And like, you know, the form factor is better. But mostly, it just looks cooler.
It looked way cooler. It looked like an Apple device. It looked
yeah.
like an iPod. Like, it was sleek.
And it's, like, genuinely the first time that you could take a Nintendo handheld, like, out in public and not be, like, embarrassed of the thing.
No, that's a really good point.
Right?
Like, because, like, the original Game Boy, lots of adults played the original Game Boy. That thing is a brick, right? It's
yeah.
not, like, stylish.
Yeah.
The Game Boy Colors had their own charm, but I feel like were mostly aimed at kids.
They're toys. They're brightly colored, and yeah.
The original Game Boy Advance, like a big weird purple Batarang.
Yes, bizarre.
And then the Game Boy Advance SP, like a significant upgrade, but
right.
still like very toy looking.
Yes.
Yeah, you're totally right. And then the original DS was hideous. But the DS Lite, they really hit on with something there.
They figured it out. Like they made it good, and that's all is launched with that white color. It is weird that when it was launched, they just called it White, and then as it went on, they had to like sort of rebrand it. They were like Polar White.
Yeah, I didn't remember that. That is
interesting. Is that weird? My X, Mark, we're on to X now. Is for XL, because we talked about like the revisions of. The DS, and you know, eventually getting to that DSi XL, which is a big version of the DSi. This is the first time, and Nintendo has done revisions on basically all of their handhelds, right? But this is the first time they made a handheld that was bigger than the one before. Everything else is shrinking it down. The Game Boy goes to the Game Boy Pocket. The SP is smaller than the original Game Boy Advance. Like
everything,
which is the smallest thing you're gonna accidentally swallow it. And even like the DS, the DS Lite, obviously smaller. Like we just get smaller, smaller, smaller. The DSi XL was sort of the first admission of like, maybe you want this to be big. Maybe you want to be able to like see what's going on this screen. And that is obviously a trend that has continued in their handhelds going forward. The 3DS obviously had XL models. And while the Switch OLED version is not physically bigger, the screen is bigger. It takes up more real estate on the front and the like kind of bezel is gone. That's something that it took them, you know, I don't know, 15 years of making handhelds to be like, oh, wait a minute, maybe it'd be nice to have a bigger one.
And not that the DS and really like the 3DS looked all that great in XL, but part of it had to have been like technical limitations. Like, could you imagine
yes.
a huge Game Boy? That screen would be so bad.
Right. What would be the point? But yeah, it's just it just funny to think that like there never was a like reason to make.
Yeah.
Like I think there probably would have been a market for like a Game Boy SP, Game Boy Advance SP with a bigger screen, or that was just like a little bit
right.
bigger.
Yeah.
Although I guess I'm essentially just describing a DS. Mark, your X.
Yeah, that's a great one. My X is for crossover device.
Ooh.
And you know, when we talked about this Blue Ocean strategy and Nintendo DS being a under Nintendog, there's like one of the big parts of it was reaching new gaming audiences, lapsed gamers, people who were not, you know, like playing video games before. Now everybody plays games. They're on everybody's mobile's phone.
Right.
You know, like in so games are so ubiquitous, but that was not the case when the Nintendo DS came out. So just some interesting stats.
God, the Nintendo DS changed the world.
No, it really did. Like, so in 2006, so not that long after the Nintendo DS had been released, right? Nintendo reported that 44% of DS owners were female. An entire generation of female gamers were born out of the Nintendo DS.
Yes.
Because it was, the majority of Nintendogs owners were female.
Yeah.
Well,
because for the first time, here's like a game that's marketed towards that audience.
Yeah, and like a game system that is getting, for whatever reason, it was really just like lightning striking that it was like, oh, we've sold, there's a ton of these out there. And a lot of the audience, like half the audience for this, are women. And so, like, we should make software, you know, that, like, appeals to them.
Right. Or at the very least, like, isn't alienating to them.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, yeah, so 44%.
Everyone else is like, Duke Nukem 4.
Make that Marine balder. So, yeah, in 2006, 44% of DS owners were female, according to Nintendo. The majority of Nintendogs owners were female. And then it wasn't just like, a divide between like men and women, all age groups as well. So in 2010, Nintendo reported that 46% of the U.S. population aged 6 to 74 used a Nintendo system that year.
Wait, give me those ages.
6 to 74.
Okay.
And 46%, so almost half of the U.S. population in 2010, in that age range, used a Nintendo system.
But you are expressing an enormous age range, right?
It is an enormous age range, that's the point,
okay,
right?
Yes, yes.
The point is that the Nintendo DS audience and the Wii audience in 20, like, the spectrum of ages of people that were engaging with this was huge. And then that the bottom fell out of that with the Wii U.
Right,
right?
Of course.
Like, because that, like, older age range, everybody migrated to their phone. Like, Nintendo
had
to find a whole new audience.
Right.
But for that brief, really just, like, six-year period, Nintendo just, like, opened the doors to gaming for so many
everyone.
People.
Yeah. Well, and, like, we've talked about it before, but, like, it's obviously like this bridge device for older people or for female gamers that had previously not, you know, felt as though they were being marketed to, which they weren't. But like, it was also something that, like, between the DS and the Wii got me back into gaming. So like, it is sort of like, and I'm like a hardcore sort of game guy. I don't know if that's true, but I guess I am. I think about video games a lot. It's just weird to think that the blue ocean strategy, which is reaching out to audiences that aren't the typical audience, can also reach me, the typical audience.
Yeah,
you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great X for crossover.
Which leads me to my Y, and my Y is Yoshi Touch and Go.
Okay, so we've done it now. This is
did we do it on Y?
Yes.
Okay, perfect.
We did it on Y.
Okay. We've talked a lot about Nintendo DS games that are amazing, and we've talked a lot about Nintendo DS games that did really like innovative things,
but are confounding.
And we're amazing or really good, and. Not to totally, I don't know what your take on Yoshi Touch and Go is, but not to like totally disregard it as like as a game. But the early days of the Nintendo DS were not all like fun and games.
Oh, I come not to honor Yoshi Touch and Go, but to bury it.
So Yoshi Touch and Go was, I would say, like in the release window of the Nintendo DS, especially in Japan. So it was released in February of 2005 in Japan, and I think like March of 2005 in the U.S. And it feels like a tech demo that was turned into a game.
Yeah, and it probably was, right? Because it is a game where the sole input is via the touch screen.
Mm-hmm.
There are sort of like alternating stages where Baby Mario is falling from the sky. And you can draw little like clouds onto the screen that sort of like guide his path as he's falling, and you kind of like block shy guys from like getting to him. No direct control over Mario himself. And then the other levels, he's on Yoshi's back, and you're just, and Yoshi just keeps walking to the right, and you have to like draw platforms for Yoshi. And again, just sort of like, you know, you can like draw circles around like coins, and then you collect the coins, or you can cordon off the shy guys into like little areas so they won't bother Yoshi as he continues walking on his path. No direct control again of Yoshi.
Yeah. And I bought this game. But really, like, in the early days of the Nintendo DS, it was slim pickings.
Yeah.
There were a lot of minigame collections. There were a lot of, like, these sorts of things that just didn't really feel like fully formed games. But in the next couple of years, the software situation would change completely.
Yeah, yeah. It just took a little while. This is one where I'm like, why isn't this part of the, like, phone game model?
Yeah.
Because it was completely touch-based.
Right.
Like, this and Kirby Mass Attack. Like, it seems like they could have been kind of, like, easy fits. And, like, if you're paying, like, $2 for a Yoshi Touch and Go on your phone, like, I'd mess around with that.
I mean, I really think it's because, well, Nintendo held their nose and did mobile gaming.
You're
because...
Right.
They had to.
Right.
But then as soon as the Switch became a hit and they've had the, you know, like, success right. in other areas, they've just dropped it completely.
Right.
They just don't care.
Yeah. They were like, people are buying how many copies of Mario Kart? I guess we don't have to do anything.
Yep.
All right. So which brings us to Z. Mark, I would like you to go first on Z's.
Okay. My Z is for Zelda.
Yeah. Which one?
Both.
I'm gonna need you to pick one.
Okay, I'll say Phantom Hourglass then.
Okay, because my Z is whichever Zelda Mark doesn't pick.
Okay.
So let's talk about them both.
Yeah, let's talk about The Legend of Zelda, the Phantom Hourglass, and The Legend of Zelda Spirit Tracks.
Mm-hmm.
Two Nintendo DS games following I think like actually like direct sequels to Wind Waker, but nonetheless have that like Toon Link aesthetic,
which I think that is the like most notable part, is that you know, with rare exceptions, the Zelda games don't really like repeat art styles between games, and certainly not between games across systems.
Yeah.
And so like this pair of Zelda games that just like borrowed the aesthetic from Wind Waker, then also shared a input method where you are not really directly controlling Link. You sort of are, but not really. The emphasis on the touch controls is so fascinating.
It is fascinating. And I would say, like, divisive.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, for my money, bad. Like, I like both of those games, but I would like them more if I could just move Link around.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's been a long time since I played
yeah.
either of them. And I would love to revisit them in the future. 'Cause once it's been, you know, like 20 years since you played something,
right.
you really say that you know what I mean?
Yeah, like, whatever thoughts you had about it, like a different human being had
yeah.
those thoughts, yeah.
But I remember being totally fine with the controls in both Phantom Hourglass and Spirit Tracks. I really love Phantom Hourglass. I think it's a really fun game. I think that there had been handheld, maybe not to the degree that New Super Mario Brothers felt like a earthquake
yeah
it when it was announced, but you know, there had been handheld Zelda games, like original handheld Zelda games
totally.
In the past, but something about it being
good ones too,
yeah, and but something about it being in that like Toon Link style with like 3D sprites,
yeah,
it felt like a, and with a whole new control scheme, it just felt like something really
yeah.
new and interesting. And I think it was, and I'm always fascinated, I think, both always fascinated by these evolutionary dead ends that Nintendo
100%
takes,
yes.
And I feel like these
and
DS games...
And Nintendo duologies, too.
Yes.
These things where, like, Nintendo does something twice, and they're like, well, okay, we're done with that.
Yeah, because there's not really a reason you couldn't have got one of these on the Nintendo 3DS.
Right.
They just didn't want to.
They just didn't do it.
Yeah.
Yeah, but bizarre stuff. And, like, they're also just, like, conceptually innovative. That, like, tower that you have to keep returning to in...
the Temple of the Ocean King.
Temple of the Ocean King in Phantom Hourglass is, like, a twist on the Zelda formula that we've not seen again since. And, like, it's Spirit Tracks, the whole, like, navigating the world via train. Again, it's another love it or hate it situation, but is totally unique, and they've never done it like that since.
Yeah.
And also, these games give us Linnabek, one of the, like, coolest additions to the Zelda canon as far as, like, sidekick characters goes. Like, he's up there with Midna, right? Where you're just like, oh yeah, I didn't realize that what the Zelda series was missing was a Han Solo, but it was, and we get him in the form of Linnabek.
And, you know, with the Skyward Sword HD having a control scheme that doesn't require motion controls, that it feels, that gives me a glimmer of hope that we will see these games in some form again in the future, like a remake or something. But I do think that if it completely loses the touch controls, maybe it will make for a better game. Like, maybe it will make, but I think you
that
will,
feels
I
tough
think,
though.
I think you'll lose something that made these games really special.
Yeah, I mean, if for no other reason, there's so many, like, puzzles and stuff where you're using that boomerang and you gotta, like, chart out its path by, like, drawing it on the screen.
And even, like, the one of the, probably, like, the most famous puzzle out of Phantom Hourglass requires you to close your DS, so that way something that was on the top screen can make an impression on the bottom screen. And that's, like, so fun. And, like, how do you replicate something like
that? Yeah, you just push the button and then it does it. Which, you know, is really all you're doing is, like, pushing a button, but there's, like, that little bit of extra immersion, which is just, like, really fun and novel. It's weird that there are, like, two big Zelda games on this thing. Like, the 3DS did have two Zelda games, right, in the form of Link Between Worlds and Triforce Heroes, but Triforce Heroes obviously comes with, like, a little bit of an asterisk. It's just like, oh, the 3D or the DS pulled it off. They got, like, two complete unique Zelda adventures.
Yep.
All right, so that is our ABCs of the Nintendo DS. Mark, let's close this out. Little pause there on the music. I hit the button, it didn't happen, and then I didn't want to, like, say anything in case it was gonna, and then it did. All right, that is going to do it for this episode of Nintendo Cartridge Society. Thank you so much for listening. Want to give a special thank you to all of our 16-bit patrons, Connor McCabe, Patrice Millette, David Hendley, Alias X, and Kyle Seaborn. We appreciate you, and we appreciate everyone who's contributing over on the Patreon, and to everyone who is listening right now. Thank you so much. You can join our Discord. All you gotta do is email us at nintendocartridgesociety@gmail.com and we will send you an invitation. Anthony DeLuca made our logo. Our theme music is provided by 8BitBetty. You can get more of his music by going to 8BitBetty.com or by listening right now. For my co-host, Mark Mitchell, this is Patrick Ehlers saying thank you for listening.